Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded, though, by people who can support us, your family, friends, and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Generational legacies are something we'd all like to leave. For some, it's a family business or wealth creation. For others, it's culture or beliefs, genetics or wisdom. Unfortunately for many, it's the results of trauma, the psychological and emotional scars that survivors of adverse experiences can pass on. As we discovered in previous conversations, there are great leaders overcoming their trauma and using their lived experience to connect with others wanting to break the intergenerational cycle. Today's guest has been raised in a family legacy of culture and tradition. Born in regional Queensland, Australia, Namaka Korowa spent the first 3 weeks of life without a name. It was his grandfather, a paramount chief of Tanna Island, Vanuatu, who bestowed him with a traditional title. The concept of paramount chief is central to Tanna's social structure, representing leadership, prestige, and cultural identity. As the 50th grandchild, it took Namaka some time to understand the significance of his birthright, the significance of being the first son of a first son in a long line of belonging. Hello, Namaka, and welcome. It's lovely to reconnect with you after all these years. You talk about ancestry with such pride, especially your name, which you say belongs to Tanna Island?
I say belongs to Tanna Island because in non-Western cultures, or a lot of Eastern cultures, you don't own the name owns you. So it was kind of like, I guess from that point of understanding, like I'd never understood it as a child. I always thought, you know, why do I have this weird name, you know, when a lot of my other cousins have very Western names, you know, Paul, Daryl, Troy, very good Australian names, and Namaka, it's like, okay, where does that fit? I think for myself, just looking back, as much as that name had to do with the shaping of my identity. So I think you got to also maybe take into context, I was born in Mackay, so Mackay as a working class community and me having a name like Namaka, I guess I always struggled to find my place. Not, you know, being black as well, but aside from that, well, not that that was a thing, because there were a lot of black other kids around. But I think growing up, as kids, you didn't notice anyone was black or someone was white or someone was Malaysian. You were just kids, you were just mates, you know? So as you get older, you sort of think, okay, well, I look around my classroom, you know, and everyone's not black. So that sort of, shaping of my mentality and fitting in or whatever it is it was.
Belonging.
I have to say this, Kim, I never really struggled with a sense of belonging. And I feel like it had a lot to do with, number one, my grandfather naming me. Like he lived in Vanuatu and come back, you know, every year. And he would ask me, I remember, as long as I can remember, as a kid, he would come back and he would say, are you coming back to the islands with me? And I'm like, nah, I'll be right. You know, I'm happy here, you know. Because I know that my mum tells me that he wanted to take me as a baby to Vanuatu to learn the customs and traditions and all that. And she's like, nah, you're not taking my baby. He's staying here. So growing up in I guess having that, I wouldn't say it's a pressure, it was more an invitation. Invitation to go back to the islands and to learn culture and that sort of thing. So obviously I didn't, so I stayed in Australia. I married a cane farmer's daughter, You know, she's got Scottish in English heritage, you know. So for me, that whole sense of identity and growing up and the path that, you know, my wife's family came over here the same time as my great-grandparents came in the late 1800s. So, and that was for the sugar industry as well. So for me, I feel like my wife and I have that, we're the story of Mackay, you know. So our children have a really well-rounded view of identity, who they are, where they fit, I feel. And, you know, obviously they, like all teenagers, you still struggle with identity and finding your place. But I think it's important to know that history as well. And it's not history, I always say to people, it's not history, because it's dark history. I'm not telling people history to blame. I'm telling history to people so that they have understanding. And my mum always used to say, don't look at where people are, look at where they come from. That in itself, that whole understanding of cultural identity, living in Australia, growing up here in Australia, you may look different, but you really are Australian. Because I always say to people, what does it mean to be Australian? You know, everybody who's here has come from somewhere else,
generally. Except for the Aboriginal people,
right.
Of course.
So that's a pretty important thing too, because that shapes our society. Yeah, you know. So, but yeah, for me, that whole cultural identity is very unique to us because of our history.
How do you think your cultural identity has shaped your values through life?
In a number of ways. Firstly, because going back to the naming, and I didn't learn this until later in life, is that when you're given a cultural name, and especially Aboriginal Islander names, the names hold significance to country or to land. So what that means is if the name is attached to a person, that name owns that person. And then that's not a bad thing, that's actually a good thing, because there's that sense of belonging right from birth. But it's also how land in non-Western cultures, how within their understanding of land ownership is that the land owns us through the name. So because the name comes from the land, and the name owns us, that's how the land owns us. Because it was here before we came, and it will be here when we're gone. We don't need it to survive. So to me, it was all of this sense of responsibility, not just ownership, so to speak. So I think that's how it's affected myself personally, thinking as I learnt that later in life, or even just a young teen or older teen, realising that the cultural name has a significance to responsibility. And I feel like that's an important part to you know, making decisions in life, is taking responsibility for yourself.
Being accountable. That's a very good value to have. How do you think you live that value?
I live that value through the decisions that I make every day, really. I guess I'm a counsellor at the moment. And I, you know, we run a business for domestic and family violence. So I feel like it's directed me in the sense that South Sea Island people were brought here as indentured labour. So
that's a nice word for being kidnapped off a beach.
100%.
Brought to work.
That's right. I feel like, you know, the hardships and the things that my forefathers went through, and also having an Aboriginal ancestor as well on my dad's side, like that's, you know, the things that our family have been through and even gotten to where they've gotten has always been because they worked for what they got. They weren't people who just waited for somebody, the government, to come and fix them, so to speak. So those values have shaped my decisions. I can't remember who it was. There was an auntie who once said, you know, there's a light at the end of every tunnel, and if there's not, get down there and light it.
Love it.
You know what I mean? But
bring a candle.
That's the type of women I grew up with. Yeah. You know, so there's that real proactive mentality. Maybe it's something that I used to do a long time ago. I remember seeing a statistic once, maybe a couple of years ago, where it said that, you know, back in the 1930s and 40s, around somewhere between 80 to 90% of people believed that it was their job as community people to take responsibility for community issues, right? Whereas, you know, 20% believed it was the government's job to fix it. Fast forward to today, and it's completely flipped. Very small percentage of people believe it's my responsibility, right? Domestic violence, I say, isn't a department issue. It's society's problem. It's a human problem, and we all have a responsibility. And I think that's the thing. It's the mentality that we've come up with these days, is that we think it's somebody else's job. Or even, you know, we have bystander training and all these types of things that are there. It's teaching people how to be aware, but also how do I be connected without getting myself into trouble? You know, so people are thinking like that.
It's really important because, you know, we have heard of instances where people have stepped in and been injured or killed themselves in those violent situations. You mentioned Reconcile Life, and I heard a lot of respect for the women in your line. And I'm wondering why, you know, domestic and family violence has even been something you're so invested in.
It's something that we started out not really considering, my wife Vicky and I, other than there was a need. So we were foster carers for about 8 years, and I think we had around 10 babies come through our home.
I remember meeting one actually from Rockhampton, the Indigenous child.
Yes, there you go, yeah. So a lot of the things that we were doing was a little bit outside the box too. So we were actually meeting with the parents and doing something that's called parent coaching. It is within child safety's policy, we later found out. Which is a good thing. Understanding what those parents' needs were, what the concerns were for child safety as well, was that yes, there was drug, alcohol influence, but the domestic violence was one of the big factors as well for those parents. And understanding what it is, what things they needed to do to, because you've got to take into account also that child safety are there for the children, child safety, right? So. But for the parents, it was difficult to try and connect them to services, especially Indigenous parents, that were, number one, culturally appropriate, but also, number two, that they felt they were connected to. With parents not understanding how to connect the dots, basically, with those concerns. So we were able to walk alongside these parents, not necessarily hold their hands, but sort of, in a way, give them the empowerment like to make those decisions. Because a lot of these, you got to admit, a lot of these parents were kids themselves. So they weren't able, or maybe didn't have demonstrated parenting.
It's like a legacy, a generational legacy. I understand that. You know, I've come from DV background, and then it was a perpetrated thing in my relationships because it's almost normalised.
100% it's normalised. And I think that's the thing. It's when it's normalised, it's, especially because we talk about culture as well. The word culture just means way. Or way of doing. So, you know, when you and that way of doing, in particular to a certain family, can be very vastly different to the person living next door. So there's a family culture. You know, so it's very multi-layered in the terms of what their understanding of is normal. And we would hear mothers say that. It's like, we just want to be normal, like normal mother, without having all the other stuff going on. So empowering those parents to be able to make, I guess, informed decisions. Keeping an appointment, what's that mean? Like going to an appointment. How difficult it was even just turning up to an appointment for bub or whatever, you know. In that, you know, their baby's with the carer and mum's got to turn up to an appointment for the baby. It's a lot of trying to execute timing and getting the parent there at the same time and all the stuff with child safety. So there's those complexities around just the logistics, I guess, with working with the mother and child safety and the baby. And making sure you're doing okay yourself, because that's a big thing as a carer, is making sure that you're in a good place. You know, I guess through our experience, you can't care for others if you're not being cared for yourself. It's harder, I should say.
You're now in local government, and one thing I only came to my attention recently is that there is not a representative for children under 12 in our parliament. I was shocked to hear that. Do you feel like representation from the governmental level of federal government should be there for children under 12, especially what we're seeing playing out in daycare facilities across Australia at the moment?
There's so many gaps at every level of government. I mean, I'm a local councillor, so I don't really get involved in federal politics or state politics, but they do impact what we do on the ground, I guess.
Well, they're the ones making the legislation. I suppose my point was more about the fact that if you don't have a minister who's representing those children, how can we regulate and legislate for change?
100%, right? Like, it's like domestic violence. It's like I've heard people say, with all good intentions, domestic violence isn't in our remit. Well, I'm like, yes, it is. Like, we have homeless people living on council land because of domestic violence, you know, and it's like joining those, understanding also, and I guess maybe this is my mentality, Kim, as someone who's growing up with, I've grown up with Western and non-Western culture. So the way that I see life, my worldview, is very holistic. Although I can work in a compartmentalized mindset, which is great. You need departments if you want to make money. Like, it's really good for that. But a holistic mindset is really about seeing the bigger picture and understanding that everything affects everything in some way, in some shape or form. And maybe that's, for some people, it's hard to understand. But for me, because we're spiritual people too, so we see a lot of things, I guess, understanding personally how things are affected. We take things on personally. And when I say we, I'm talking about people with culture. And that culture doesn't necessarily, I don't mean just black culture, so to speak. I'm talking about people who have, that holistic worldview. And that can be anybody. Like, I often say to people, you go far enough back in your genealogy, at some point your forefathers lived in a village. Right? So it's that the holistic mindset isn't just a culture thing, it's actually a human thing. You know, and I've heard people say, yes, it takes a village to raise a child, but most people don't want to live in a village, right? So for me, it's like, how do you get that mentality into federal parliament when everything's so divisive, especially in political climate like today?
Some of the biggest perpetrators of bullying I see on a regular basis.
So, you know, when you see that, I feel like I'm actually just working on a post right now, just an info thing around relationships. And one of the posts is, don't expect the school to teach your children how to have healthy relationships. It starts at home. It starts with how we act.
And it's been modelled prior to them getting to school for five years.
That's right, 100%. And so that's really important, you know. And I go back to this statistic of people thinking it's the government's job to make my kids better. It's like, no, you're the parent. And it's your responsibility and privilege. Don't forget that. It's not just, and I think that's the thing too, is that children are a gift, you know, and maybe that's also something else that needs to be addressed as well, is that to have children is so important for us to understand, because what it means is that we're able to sow seeds into those children, water those seeds, and then just watch them grow in themselves. And to be their own person, you know, with that good upbringing, you know. And that's in an ideal world. Now, you go back to your leadership within government and how much today people are so easily influenced by what they see on screens, in particular to do with governments, and that people getting the information off social media and whatever else. You know, they have 2,000 friends on Facebook, but they never spoke to anyone all day today. You know what I mean? So that, to me, that's a problem. Like, to me, that's a society that has a perceived connection, not a real connection. It's virtual reality, right? So virtual means almost real, not really real.
I did a whole TEDx talk on virtual connection and how what we're missing is actual connection.
100%.
Like, you and I are sitting here today face to face having a conversation. I mean, I can see your facial features, I can feel your energy. That's not something you can get online.
Not at all. And that's where misinterpretation, misinformation, all of these things come, right? Because what I hear and what I read can be felt differently, you know. And you take that, you give that to a parent, for example, who can't read. You know, so how are they taking on even just the limited maybe information that they get, and how do they process that without support or connection? So,
amazing story. One thing I'd like to cover off on, reconcile life. Why do you think it's so important for people to have access to that type of systemic change that you're offering through courses and through gathering?
Firstly, the idea of domestic and family violence being addressed by institution, right? So you've got family problems at home and we're trying to fix it with institution. If you think about how important it is, well, the importance is, what that means is that people aren't able to access connection in their community, or for whatever reason, and whatever type of access that means. It could be as simple as a child has a connection with their netball coach or their football coach, right? So those are, like, sports is such an important connection for kids.
And it's cultural too. Like, it's a culture. Sports has its own culture.
100%. And so I guess when you live in a society today where everybody is time poor and they're living on the internet, and, you know, even kids today, you know, it's just a given that they have social media understanding or whatever, but they're already being taken in their mind from this physical connection that you just spoke of, the person to person. And speaking culturally as well, I remember an old uncle saying they used to sit in the room with their old South Sea Islander uncles and aunties and not say a word. But they know that they knew by sitting in the same room there was a spiritual connection happening. And in the spiritual connection and that type of thing, there's safety, there's healing, right? There's all of these things that can happen in the right environment. It's important for people to have access to services like Reconcile Life. There aren't a lot of services like Reconcile Life because, again, I go back to people just can't make, or not they can't, they have difficulty connecting the need for a service like Reconcile Life, because we're not technically a counselling agency, even though we've done counselling, and my wife's a counsellor, and we've done, you know, healthy relationships work, and we're not recognised as that because our approach is holistic, right? So, yes, most of our referrals come through domestic violence court, but Kim, we're getting people from mental health, we're getting people from AODs, like people that have been addicted to ICE, like coming to our service. Like, we're not technically a...
drugs counselling.
Right? Mm. But because we deliver healthy relationships from cultural perspectives, they're connecting to it. And the connection, when I say connecting to it, I'm saying they're connecting to other humans.
They're connecting to a human process with humans.
Which isn't new. You don't need to read it. It's ancient, right?
So
it's
going back to the village.
Exactly. So what we're doing is we're not doing anything, you know, profound, other than that we're just helping people connect again.
What's one change you'd like to see in the world in relation to the work you're doing and what you've actually learned?
Education to people who have the ability, but maybe feel afraid. Not afraid, not just afraid, but feel unequipped, you know. And there are so many good standing, law-abiding citizens out there who put their hands in the air and say, I would love to know how I could help, but it doesn't seem like it's my thing, it's my responsibility, or it's... And I'm not saying just get any random person out there to do this type of thing. I know that there are people out there who have access and are already pursuing avenues on how they can help, say, the youth crime problem, but they don't know where the funding is, right? Because technically the funding doesn't go to grassroots approaches, it goes to institutions, which is good. But I feel like in a perfect world, and now that there is research happening with grassroots approach, and also connecting back to spiritual understanding, all these types of things that are happening at academic level, it's important for governments, these key decision makers, to know, you know what, there are other ways to approach these problems. It's, you know, insanity, you know, to keep doing the same thing. If we're looking at measured approaches, we're looking at things that are not, you know, a new idea, but actually some of the old ways. And when I say old ways, people automatically get a little red flag and say, old ways, we don't want old ways. It's like, hang on a second. There were a lot of things in the old ways that were really, really bad, and we should never, ever go back to that. We should learn about them and teach our children not to do it. But there were a lot of things in the old ways that were actually good, right? Which was connection with my uncles and aunties, right? I know within Aboriginal Islander culture, Kim, that there was a thing that happened, and again, through colonisation and everything else that went on within our society, whenever problems happened within cultural families, uncles and aunties and cousins were always there. Right? So you had this village. What happened with colonization and with assimilation is that when the institution stepped in, the family stepped out.
What do you want people to know about DV, about domestic and family violence, that you think needs, you know, a little bit more prominence in education?
I did a little exercise a little while ago where I asked some professionals if they could name 10 beers. All right, and they're like, what? What are you talking about? Name me 10 beers. And they rattled them off like you wouldn't believe. And I said, okay, now name me 8 types of domestic violence. There was a pause. And they gave me about 3 or 4. If that's our professional, people that are educated, that have, you know, and also have ability to influence, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if our leaders, potentially even being impacted by it or doing it, right? I can say that I've done camps where, because with our program, we do camps on country, and I don't just do them for Indigenous people, I do them for non-Indigenous. And we have our elders come along, traditional owners. We'll go out to these camps and we'll talk about domestic violence and what it is. And I did one with some non-Indigenous men, and they're not just, you know, people of lower socioeconomic. These were, I'm talking about health professionals, teachers, like, that came to our camp just as a pilot sort of thing, you know. They were really happy to come along. A number of these men said, Namaka, when you did that talk about domestic violence, I think I do some of those things. It's understanding that today what we call domestic violence is, and in what is in people's heads of what domestic violence is, can be very limited. Because I know with men who will be referred to us through the DV court, that they're coming to me saying, well, the magistrate said that I need to come and see you before he sentences me. And I'm saying, okay, well, do you know what you're here for, though? And he said, well, I don't know, I didn't hit her. So, you know, and these are men that are coming through court. So then the process of teaching them, okay, well, what's isolation? What's coercion and threats? What does it mean to use children? You know, so there's these types of behaviours that we're seeing as cultural norms. And when I say cultural norms, we're talking about family culture.
Yeah, right? Australian family culture, which is very sad.
And so people are saying, well, that's not domestic violence, that's just how we talk to each other.
Mm.
Well, that's not domestic violence, that's just how we treat each other. Because, you know, if I can intimidate you to make you do what I want you to do, that's just how granddad talks to us. Or my grandfather did that, so I can do it. You know, all of these behaviours, that's, you know, that seem like a family culture, is all laced with abuse that people don't actually realise. And then they're wondering later in life why they have a problem with guys like that. They don't know where it comes from, but because of the nature of the violence in and of itself, they don't see it as violence. They think it's their right. Well, not just their right, but they think it's their duty. I guess there's a lot to be said about that. We don't have enough time to talk about here, but I do know that's something at all levels of our community, that people know the definition of what domestic violence is. But on the other side of that is that healthy relationships. What does it look like to have a healthy relationship? Not just what the definition is, Kim, but can we demonstrate it? Because kids don't just do what you say, they do what you do. They watch your life. They watch how you treat other people. They listen to how you speak to others. And then later on in life, it comes out.
Well, I've just felt a lot more responsible for a lot more than I did before this conversation.
Don't worry, I speak like this and I'm convicting myself too, don't worry.
Namaka, I can't tell you what an absolute honour and pleasure it's been to reconnect with you in this way. And we will be delving deeper into a lot of those conversations. So prepare yourself, and thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Director of Reconcile Life and Local Government Councillor Namaka Korowa, sharing his vision of a future where respect and values form a foundation for relationships in our communities. You can learn more about what constitutes domestic and family violence online via government websites and if you search for counselling hotlines or family support services in your local area. All the links for Namaka are in the show notes, and you can always reach out to me via the contact page on my website and I'd be glad to help. KimClyden.com. That's KimCleidon. While you're there, subscribe to the RSS feed of this podcast or my monthly newsletter for instant access to offers, perks, workshops, and a massive network of people being the change they want to see in the world. Until next week, take care and bye for now.